As you know, I love to sit and ponder things, and I ponder our position here often, because we live beyond our capabilities in many respects, and that's the way it should be. I was talking to a guy once, a business guy, and he was talking to us, and he said, "Boy, you're not in a very good position." And I remember stopping him saying, "We are in the best position right now." He said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "We can't do it on our own." And he looked at me and said, "Wait, I know that's different economics. But see, when you can't do it on your own, if it gets done, who did it?" One of the worst things we could do is be positioned to steal glory from God. If you cannot do it on your own, then who gets the glory? Now, if you look at what we're about, we're not about having glory given to us. We're about showing the world who God is. And if you're going to show the world who God is, you have to be positioned in weakness to do that. You cannot be positioned in strength to do that. There is no possible way. If you've ever, and I don't think any of you have been around when someone's brought some students here and they want me to teach them how to run a nonprofit ministry, I have no idea how to. I usually start telling them, first of all, you got to be gifted at just about nothing. And they look at me and do your response. But I'm thinking, honestly, you know, I speak, I can't spell, my grammar stinks. You guys in class know I can't even run a copy machine effectively. Does that mean you can't be used of God? No, a donkey can be used of God. See, there's a difference there. It's not that you don't prepare and you don't use the skills you have and the talents God's given you. That's not it. But what we have to understand is that we have to live beyond our capabilities if God's going to get glory. What I was listening, I listened to public radio because a guy gave me a gift of Sirius Radio or whatever that's called, and it's the cheapest package. And so I don't get any other news channels. So I listen to public news. And there's interesting news talk programs on there. And there was a guy once that they were talking about, and he specializes in economics. And he was specializing in people economics. And I thought, that's interesting. You know that people actually specialize in trying to figure out how you think so that they can use you to make money. They want your resources and your time, and they want to use you to make money for themselves. When you go to Walmart, those end caps are not for your benefit. When you go to a store, there's studies done and things are put at a certain level for a certain reason. That's people economics. They're working at figuring out how people operate. This guy was given an example. He was hired as a consultant for a ski lift company. And he told them, well, what you got to do is offer tickets that are non-refundable 3 months ahead of time. Why? Because it'll work, believe me. They'll pay it and offer them cheap. Offer them like a third of the cost. You'll come out fine. Why? Well, he proved it to them. People, when they do that, they order way ahead of time. They only use the same amount as if they bought them for full price. And so they come out just fine and they have the money ahead of time. And that's people economics. What they do is they study people and they figure out how they operate and then they set up a system so that they win from using the people. And you may say, I don't believe that, but they do. That's why advertisers spend millions and millions and millions of dollars on advertising, like for Super Bowl, that kind of thing. They've got studies that will show that what they're showing you will actually get into your head and you will actually use it. Well, I started thinking about spiritual economics, actually. I started to think, you know, economics is the social science that seeks to describe the factors which determine the production. So I'm starting to think, what are the factors that determine the production? What are we trying to produce here? Well, we're trying to know Christ to make him known. We're trying to produce Christ followers. So I started to play with the idea of, well, then what are the factors that we have to look at to produce Christ followers? And I have four principles I want to share with you. The first principle, the first spiritual economics principle is this. It's simple. God brings down the proud, but he helps those who are helpless, who depend on his deliverance. That's interesting. It seems like we grew up in the United States of America where we do pride ourselves in pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps. and somehow being self-made and somehow figuring things out. And even if you go to ministry or church or other seminars, you're told how you can do this, how you can set this up and this can happen, how X and Y equals Z one day, you know, or whatever it might be. Well, that could be. But as you look in the Bible, you begin to see that God took an awful lot of people that really shouldn't have been doing what they're doing and did it anyway. He seemed to use people that didn't and couldn't steal the glory from him. And I talked about that a little bit, but that's the very first principle. I was thinking about Zechariah, and I'm not going to get into it real deeply with you because we'd be here forever talking about the book of Zechariah, and I know you all just read that probably. Zechariah, he became, as you began to read in chapters 9 to 14, he was an old man. Israel was weak and vulnerable and under foreign domination. It was before Nehemiah. Israel is surrounded by powerful and aggressive neighbors. And of course, you all took Steve's class, you know this. Was this a disaster for them or the perfect setup? That's the question. When you look at our life here in ministries, I pray for God to honor himself. And as you pray for God to honor himself, is it going to be where it looks really tough, or is that the perfect situation for him to do it? I mean, think of the children of Israel. They're in the land of Egypt. There is no way to get out of there. Oh, yes, there is. Yes, there is. Oh, but not because of your strength or your power or your ability. We'll use Moses. He's been sitting in the desert for 40 years. How much does he know now about leading people? It's interesting when you look at it. Chapters, I want to read something, I want to get it right. The temple had been long completed. Zechariah is now an old man. Israel is still weak. I mean, right now the situation is such, and yet Zechariah is going to prophesy that there's going to be good things that are going to come. Really. You know, just down the road a little bit, this guy Alexander the Great's going to come. He was no slouch. He was pretty powerful. Chapter 9 emphasizes that God will bring down the proud, and he helps those who are helpless, who depend on his deliverance. I couldn't help but go back in the Bible and say, who are the proud? I mean, you ever figure, we as evangelicals, we get together and talk about things, but we're never a part of that group. Like, if I was here talking about the greedy, you know, that's not me. Now, if I'm talking about, you know, whatever. So if I'm talking about proud, it's like, no, that's not me. So what I have to do often, because I can lie to myself and I don't like looking clearly at myself, so I'll go to the Bible and I'll look for a definition. And unfortunately, when I do that, I know I do that, but then unfortunately, I fit the definition most of the time. So then you got to deal with it. And so one of the things that I do know throughout Scripture is that it's very clear that Satan's huge sin, if you want to call it that, is pride. That there's no way that God will ever, ever bless pride. There's just no way. So I need to know if I'm proud. That's what I need to know. In Psalm 110:4, it says, in the pride of his face, the wicked does not seek him. Very simple thought. One of the definitions of those that are proud is they don't seek God. They don't look for him. I can ask myself that question. I want you to ask yourself that question. Are you seeking God, really? I mean, when you have your quiet time, you open your Bible, are you seeking God, or are you just having a quickie moment there, or you just want to make sure today doesn't, you don't get hit by lightning or something? You know, I mean, what's the purpose in your opening that Bible? The proud don't seek God. When I talk to individuals and just they begin to talk to me about their life, oftentimes I'll ask them, so are you in the Word? And, well, you know, I struggle with that. Perhaps that's the only thing you shouldn't struggle with. Struggle with watching TV. Struggle with going to movies. Struggle with anything else. But don't struggle with being in God's Word. Why? There's no hope for anybody that doesn't seek God. There is no hope for anyone without God. There is none. And those who know that and intentionally do not seek him. You see, the pride, the wicked, they don't seek him. in order to seek God, a lot of times there has to be a tragedy. The people who faced this in the Appleton area, they were seeking answers. They were seeking God. Why? Because it was senseless and tragic. I don't want to wait till tragedy to seek God. I don't want you to wait. The wise, the humble, they seek God because every day they know that they're not in charge. I mean, what are you actually in charge of? Are you going to take another breath? You don't know that. Are you going to be here a year from now? You don't know that. What are you really in charge of? See, we need to go to the one who is in charge on a regular basis and seek him. There's other verses. Proverbs 16, 18. It describes those that are pride have a haughty spirit. Pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. The haughty spirit, what that means is they lift themselves up. That would be another way of saying it. So I came to you and said, you know, Dave's really something. I can do this, I've done that. I try and build myself up. That's pride. And that one may be more obvious than those who don't seek him. 1 Corinthians 4, 7. For who sees anything different than you? What do you have that you did not receive? The prideful are those that believe that they have things that were not gifts of God that are good. You know how easy it can be for everything to change? And it does. The humble come to God and they're thankful that today they can eat. The humble come to God and are thankful that today their loved ones and their lives are still around them. The humble come to God and realize that the sun rose today because of his grace and mercy. See, the arrogant forget these things. And they begin to believe that the systems work without the Creator. And that's not true. If we're going to be what we can be, we need to be people who are humble this summer, not those who are proud. Not those who have false humility or anything else, but those who seek God and understand that it's not about us. We have to understand that you walk around this place, and I am, again, very fortunate that I know the story behind every building. It isn't because we're very good at doing what we do. Oh, did God use the talents? Sure, look at the old temple. I mean, the old temple, they had craftsmen. Our craftsmen are, you know, Troy and Tom and Dan, and they're out there, they're doing their thing, man, and that's how God uses that craft. But the minute that Troy and Dan and Tom think that it's them, God will have a donkey in there doing it. You see, it's one of those things. We can look at, you know, look what we did here on the, you know, Dave Cooper on the, look what I did with this, and before you know it, a lightning bolt hits it and nothing works. Instead, Dave could say to God every day, thanks for no lightning today, because you're in charge of that. Last night, I realized again how poor I am at predictions when the power flickered. It flickered, and the last time I told Linda, that's it, and as soon as I said it, it went back on. I don't know anything sometimes. Alexander the Great's invasion shows that God brings down the proud, but helps those who are helpless and depend on his deliverance. What's interesting is in the book of Zechariah, I'm just going to review it a little bit with you, that, you know, Zechariah says that Tyre, the city Tyre, had built itself a rampart. It was 700 yards from the coast. It had a double 150-foot wall around it. 150-foot wall. Cardin, how tall is that? 15-story building. All the way around it twice. You think these people depended on God for their safety? They depended on that wall. They were 700 yards from the coast. You know what else they had? They had a great navy. I don't know what a great navy can... Steve, what did a great navy consist of back then? Did they have, like, boats where they threw things at each other, or what? I have no idea. Must not have been, but they must have had a great navy, according to history. So they had 700 yards on the coast. They had a Navy guard in it. They had two walls, 150 feet tall, double, going around it. And what did Zechariah say? You're going down. Really? There's not any human reason. There is no human thinking that would take Tyre down. There's no way. There's no way that they could go down. Oh, except for it happened. Let me read this to you. In 334 BC, Alexander, who was about 21, set out with an army of 35,000 men, moving west through modern-day Turkey, which is under the Persian rule. He defeated Darius at the Battle of Issus, which is not spelled like, and I probably mispronounced it, but it's Issus, and then marched south, sending one of his commanders to Damascus. While he moved unhindered towards the Phoenician cities, Tyre was a proud and mighty city that had already withstood 5 years siege. They've already withstood, before Alexander got there, they already withstood a 5 year siege by the Assyrians. Now remember, Zechariah said, they're coming down in the future. They're down. They were not afraid. And a 13-year siege, this guy Nebuchadnezzar, remember him? He tried to take them for 13 years and failed. Nebuchadnezzar was no slouch. They weren't worried about Alexander. It's interesting. It goes in here and talks about the words in the scripture that talk about Tyre, and it all goes with strength of a city. But God used Alexander to bring the city down. It took him 7 months, during which time his army took the rubble from the original city, built a causeway to the island city. He thus fulfilled literally the prophecy of Ezekiel 26, 12, and 14, where God says that he will throw Tyre's stones and timbers into the water. It wasn't a human that was going to do this. God said it was going to happen. He said it was going to happen before it happened. Why? Because Tyre trusted in themselves. They trusted in 250-foot walls. They trusted in their navy. What I want you to get, and what we're probably missing, is the extraordinary prophecy about the idea that this city that nobody could imagine falling was going to fall. See, we don't get that because we just don't think about it, probably. But here's what's even more interesting to me. According to the Jewish historian Josephus, the Antiquities of the Jews, Baker reprint, when the high priest heard that Alexander was moving north toward Jerusalem, he entreated the Jews to offer sacrifices and praise. God told the priest in a dream to open the city gates, dress his fellow priests in white robes, and put his own priestly garments, and to march out to meet Alexander. So God gave him the message, go meet Alexander. The guy that's taking every city, the guy that's going to, you go meet him. You have no power. The mighty general who bowed to no one saw this entourage, the priest coming out. What did he do? He fell on his knees before the high priest, went into the city and offered sacrifices to the Lord. The priest showed Alexander the scroll of Daniel, which predicted that he would be a world conqueror. Alexander's men were astonished at his actions and asked him why he bowed before the high priest. He replied that he didn't bow before the priest, but before God. Yeah, I wanted to be there. The most powerful man in the world came and bowed because God said to. But before God, who made the... And let me read that. Alexander was astonished. Men were astonished by his action and asked him why he bowed before the high priest. He replied that he didn't bow before the priest, but before God, who made him high priest. Because while he was in Macedonia, he had a dream. He had seen this high priest in his robes, and he told him that he would conquer the Persians. We do not know whether Josephus' story is true or legend. We don't know any of that stuff. We do know that Tyre fell. And it wasn't because of any human doing. It was because God directed humans. Alexander has some great quotes, and one of them he said is, I'm not afraid of an army of lions led by sheep. I'm afraid of an I'm afraid of an army of sheep led by a lion. You know, you and I are able to follow the Lion of Judah. We are able to follow somebody who knows what to do. Messiah's two comings show that God brings down the proud but helps those who are helpless. You could go look at it, Zechariah 9. I mean, Jesus coming, you and I are not going to be able to resolve the world's issues. He will. He will come and make this thing right. When I talk to the first graders or I talk to the parents down in the Appleton area, it's like, you know what? I can't make anything right out of this. But I know this, our God will. He will. Why? Because he does. I can't make it right. We live in a sinful, fallen world, and I am helpless to turn this thing around. But he is not. And you have to be patient because his character will win. See, the hope is not in our strategy or our words. The hope is not in what we do. The hope is in him. Period. Oh, and by the way, some people get stoned and thrown in furnaces. Our hope is not in the circumstances working out for us. The hope is in him. And those who hope in him will never be disappointed. God's future deliverance of his people show that God brings down the proud. I just want you to see that. You go back into Zechariah and look at it. Humble people, what do they look like? Well, they're servants. They don't demand their own rights or ways. They don't do that. They're submitters. I don't even know if I spelled that right. But they're submitters. They understand their dependence. They count it a service. They count service as a privilege, not a burden. See, the humble look a certain way. They look like humble people. Oh, you and I, we can get out of order. And what, you know what we could do? We could be people who look humble but aren't. We got it out of order. You're humble when you acknowledge who God is on a moment-by-moment basis and that you aren't God, but he is. That's the first spiritual economic point, that unless we're people who are truly humble and acknowledge who God is and allow him to work, that there's no way that he'll work. The economic system will fall apart. It starts with humility and knowing that he's God and I'm Dave. The second spiritual economic principle is that we need to abide. Now, you know what I love about these principles is that we can do these. If you were to ask me right now to go straighten out the world, I can't do that. No, but I can do this. See, you know how many times we get stuck at looking at something we can't do? And how that drives us crazy? I mean, I can't do sorry that scene down in Appleton still's on my mind, but I mean, I kept thinking, I can't fix this. Will you come and talk to him? Yeah, I will. But I don't know what to say. I can't fix it. So what do you say? This stinks, sin stinks, but God will fix it. I mean, that's all I can say. Why? Because he will. One of the things that gets you to that point, this gentleman that was killed on the bridge, when the autopsy report came back, he had 7 shots in him. His daughter had 3, his wife had 3, and the other man that died had 1. There's no proof of anything. I just can't help but believe that this man that took 7 was probably stepping towards the shooter. And before he died, he looked at him and said, I forgive you. That doesn't come from an arrogant person. That doesn't come from anyone who doesn't know God. That isn't something that you're thinking about as you went on the bridge. Should somebody show up with a gun and blow me away, I'm going to look at him and say, I forgive him. That isn't rehearsed. How does that happen? In the spiritual economics of things, it happens when we abide in him. Because Jesus would have done that. Jesus did that. He was hung on a cross and he looked at the people and said, Father, forgive them. Why? They didn't know what they were doing. John 15:4-6, abide in me and I in you. This is something I can do. This is something all of you can do. You can do this. You can abide. You can spend time with God. And that's what we need to do. Sometimes people enter summer saying, it's so busy. You know what? You do what you want to do in life. You want to spend time with God, get up early and spend time with him. Stay up a little later. Do whatever you need to do, but you need to spend time with him. Why? It's part of the spiritual economics. It's what makes it work. If you're not doing it, it won't work. I promise. You know, first you have to be humble. See, otherwise you can't even come to God. I mean, if you're coming to God saying, I really don't need to come to you today, that doesn't work. And then you have to actually abide. Abide in me. As a branch, you know the analogy there is I'm a branch. I need to get all of my energy from the vine. You cut it off, it doesn't work. I've been cutting a bunch of little trees at my house. They all wither and die. Just cut it off someday and see. See how long it lasts without being connected. Abide in me and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. There's no way that we're going to be fruitful this summer if we don't abide in God. Oh, you know, we can conjure up fruit. You can say this happened, that happened, whatever. I can get people to sign rocks, throw them in a jar, and say we're successful. I mean, if that's what we're about, we can do that. But that's not what we're about. The sad thing is that, in one respect, and maybe a good thing, is that oftentimes we don't understand the benefit or the fruit that we're working towards right now. Because it doesn't come till years later. And we may never know that. We may never understand the impact that God has for somebody just because we spent time with them. Every summer, there are a few people that I watch that I'm all amazed by. I mean, there's no other word for it. They seem to be connected to those who come. They seem to be looking for people to impart God to. They seem to be waiting for opportunities. Where others are busy trying to make sure they guard their time and their, you know, freedom and their chill space or whatever. You know, if we're going to be people that are humble, the next thing is spend time somehow trying to figure out how can I spend time with God. And not just time, but continuous time. You know, the Bible gives us some challenges. It says to pray without ceasing. That's a challenge. And doesn't mean, you know, stay on your knees 24 hours a day. That's not what it means. But it does say pray without ceasing. So what is the principle? The simple way I understand it, and again, I have to understand something simpler because I can't understand the complicated part. And maybe someday I will, but now it's still simple. Is that God is around me 100% of the time. I need to act like it. That means I can talk to him any moment. It means when I went and talked to first graders about a crazy man, he was there. And I could count it. See, I knew that. I just didn't know what to say. And I remember right before I spoke, I said this little thing to God. I said, God, please give me the words that first graders will understand. Why? Because I don't know what to say. Other than, this is bad. And I think that's how I started out. This is bad. I don't even remember how I finished. But I do remember that's how I started. Because I couldn't think of anything else to say. How do you come up with things? God says, it's not for you to come up with. I'll give you the words when the time's right. Yeah, but don't you spend hours and hours in study? Yeah, you do, and you abide with him, yes. But see, there's no way that you can predict what words you need to say. You don't know who's going to be here next week, next coming off that bus, doing that. You don't know. You don't know what they need to hear. You don't know what they, you don't, right now, you don't know. You can make a plan. I'm going to sit down with somebody and lead them to Christ this way. It won't work. Why? There is a way, and it's up to God, not you. My job is something I can do. I cannot make sure everybody here is safe, by the way. I cannot make sure that everybody does what they're supposed to. I cannot. And believe me, there were years of my life where I was troubled by that because as the president of the ministry, when things go wrong, I am to blame. So what do? I abide in him. Because that's all you can do. And that works. God somehow gives you the right words at the right time for the right situation. And when you're done, you walk away going, whoa, God, that was good. And everyone thinks you actually said it. And you did, because your lips are moving. But don't forget the donkey. His lips are moving too, I imagine. It's a matter of abiding. The spiritual economic principle two is abide, and I'm going to ask you to abide this summer. The spiritual economic principle three, expect. Live expectantly. When you're going into the summer, there are people that always think, well, I just want to get through this summer. I think there's times where you try and do that, but I think if you get in the habit of doing that, you've lost an awful lot of opportunities because you're just trying to get through it rather than enjoy what God wants to do through you. It says in the seventh verse, if you abide in me and my words abide in you, if you actually are going to do this, I mean, if you're actually going to abide in me and I'm going to abide in you, then do what? Ask whatever you wish. Now, a lot of people just want to ask whatever they wish and say, God, you're my sugar daddy in the sky, so I want this to happen or whatever. That's not what it says. It says, if you abide in me and I in you, if you're and I are inseparable, and you're thinking like you should, then ask whatever you want. And it'll be done for you. By this, my Father's glorified, that you bear much fruit. See, I hope you're going into the summer thinking, God, I want this to be the best summer in the world for everybody that comes here that I get contact with. I want you to use me somehow to show them who you are. See, you're looking for it. So you're living expectantly. There are those that get up in the morning and they live expectantly. They do. They get up and say, God, man, I woke up. I got another day. There will be people who don't wake up tomorrow. See, because we're not in charge of that. But you wake up, you got another day. Now, so you can live expecting. You say, okay, God, what's today then? I wonder who I have to meet. I wonder what I have to say. I wonder, now, you know what's really cool about that? Then you go all day looking. No, I hope you can go all summer looking for how God's going to use you to change somebody's life. And look to change your life. See, that's living expectantly. And again, can you do that? Yeah, I can do that. I'm not asking you to change the world. I'm asking you to live expectantly. I'm asking you to live as if God's going to do something because he is. I'm asking you to spend time with him. I'm asking you to be humble enough to realize that you have to spend time with him. That's all. These are all things we can do. That's why they're part of spiritual economics. Because they're things that if we do, they alter the course of life. Abide in me and I in you. By this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit, and so prove to be my disciples. Now those people who really abide in him, it's obvious there's fruit. There's obvious fruit down the road. Oh, again, you may not see it all. Being in youth work for all these years, I am so thankful that some of us up here are getting older, and we have the privilege now of looking back and seeing people that have actually come through these gates as young people. I get an extraordinary privilege of seeing some of you even. Jason mentioned he was a young man here, and Dave Cooper as staff director 1 year. You look and you see people who were here as kids. I look at the Abaticola family, and I still remember, Dave as a 7-year-old little boy. No, off the street in my Sunday school class. There are moments that are good. Now, I can't tell you how everyone got to where they are today. I can't do that, but there are moments. I mean, whenever I look at Carden, too, I think, that's a generation where he was actually one of my dad's clubbers, one of my dad's kids, and I think of another generation that went before me. See, there are moments where you look and you see fruit. You just see it. And it's those moments that you're thankful for the fruit. But you do know that if there's going to be fruit, there's going to be a preparation for the fruit so that it can happen. Fruit needs to absorb what's right, and you need to watch the environment. All that stuff. And the economic part of it is simple. I need to be humble enough to know that I need God every day, and I need to abide in him. And I need to then live expectantly. And the fourth economic principle, the last one I'll share with you this afternoon, is to be intentional about dying to self. See, sometimes we hope that we just die to self accidentally. That's not how it happens. You see, self is this all-consuming animal sometimes that wants to be fed over and over and over again. I have to learn to say no to myself. How do you do that? Well, you don't do it. This is the fourth principle. Because if you haven't done the first three principles, you're not going to get here. This one doesn't make any sense. In fact, if you do it out of order, if you do this one first, it's legalism. That's not how it works. You can't do this one first. This one has to come last. So first, you have to be humble enough to come to God and say, God, I'm not God. You are. That's first. Then you go, wow, you love me. I'm going to spend time with you. Abide. That's second. Oh, wow, you'll use me. That's expectant. I'm going to look for that. And who do I use? Those who aren't in the way. So get out of the way, Dave. All right, so it's not about me, huh, God? No. All right, I'm gone. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I've loved you. You think about that statement. Just think about that one. Here's my commandment. This is like God's royal suggestion. God's idea for a happy life. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. What did Jesus do for us? By the way, he would have been God whether he came down here to earth or not. He could have just wrote us all off. He didn't. What did he give up so that we could be a part of God's family? That's the question. And then he says, I want you to be that way. I want you to be that way. You know, when God says things, we need to really pay very close attention because of the fact that he made us and he knows how we are made and how we operate right. And we'll operate right if we listen to him. I was not made to be focused on Dave Wager. I was made to be focused on others. And I'll never be okay if I focus on me. And that sounds like something you've heard in Sunday school and everything else, and you have, I'm sure. But again, in evangelical world, this doesn't apply to me. It's everyone else that has to listen to it. And that's the problem. It does apply to me, and it applies to you, and we have to understand that. In a real quick summary, it's the helpless. When they actually understand their helplessness, it turns to hope. There's no way that anyone can have hope without being helpless. It starts with our depravity and understanding. It starts with knowing that we're separate. That's where it starts. Then that helplessness can turn into hope. And then as we abide and expect and participate by dying to self, we can expect fruit. And when we see fruit, we can just be thankful that God would even have us be a part of it. He doesn't need us to be a part of it. Whether the story about Alexander the Great is accurate, it's not from the Bible, by the way, so I'm not saying that is. That's from Josephus. He's not the Bible. Most historians think he's pretty accurate on what he says. But I do know that God is accurate on everything he says. Here's what I'd like you to do this afternoon. I like doing communion in different ways. And what I'd love for you to do, it's a beautiful day, and I'd love for you to spend some time just thinking about who God is and your position and what you want to accomplish this summer. And maybe ask yourself the questions of, you know, have I lost the fear of God? Am I somebody who is humble before him anymore? Do I abide in him, really? I mean, do I really abide in him? Do I live expectantly? As I look to the summer, am I expecting God to do things? You know, what I want you to do is there's some communion things up here. I've done it a different way. I was trying to think of how I could do it so that everybody can participate and not have some food allergies or anything. So if not, just get your own stuff. But there are some crackers up here. They're Triscuits. They're rice Triscuits, actually, is what they are. And I put them in some bags, and if I don't have enough, I've got boxes of them here and some more bags if we run out. And there's some cans, little cans of grape juice and water. It's not the color or the substance. It's the memory we're going for here. So you can pick either one, whatever you're comfortable with. But I'd like you to take the juice and the water and the cracker, and I'd like you to go somewhere and just talk to God. I'd love you to focus on Him for a little bit, just Him. Because He said we need to love others like He loved us, and that's what we do in communion. We remember what He did. See, He gave His body for us to be broken for us. He didn't have to do that, but He did. That's our example for summer right there. He gave His blood for us. And after you've thought about that for a while, and you've really thought about it, and I think sometimes, you know, I'm not against communion in church, I just think sometimes we have to do it too quickly so we don't get the time to really ponder what we should. So that's why I thought I'd give you time. We said we'd end at 4 something, it's 3:15, so you got plenty of time. You do know, too, that if there's sin in your life, this is the time to get serious and talk to God about it and just say it, confess it, talk to Him. If you have hatred in your heart towards somebody, this is the time to get rid of that. Get rid of it. You say, well, I go and confess it to the person. Well, if you hurt them, sure, but sometimes you can look at somebody have hate. I'm not sure you need to go tell them that you every time you look at them, you hate them. I think you need to straighten that out. But if you've hurt somebody, sure, you need to go talk to them. And I'm going to ask you not to take that communion until you straighten things out. When you're convinced that things are the way they should be, then you take it. Between you and God, and between you and others. When you're convinced things are right, and when you've taken some time to remember what Jesus did for you, then go ahead and take it. And you know, I've said this often because I think it's a word picture for me. If you really don't want to follow Jesus, you really don't want to do this, then you take that water, that juice, and you pour it on the ground. Don't drink it. Because I'm not sure you understand what He did for us yet. And it's kind of a waste for you anyway. You may say, that's pretty harsh. Well, I'm not saying you have to do that today. You might keep it a few days. But drink it down the road. None of this stuff needs refrigeration. What I'm asking you to do is very simple. Do something you can do. Let's get right with God. Let's make sure we're right with God. Let's remember what He did for us. Let's put ourselves where we are humble before Him. Where we do abide with Him. Where we expect Him to do great things and where we're willing to die to ourselves. And where we know that we're right with Him, we're right with other people, and we're heading into the summer that way, then take communion. I know that you will never know everything you need to straighten out because God's merciful. And if He gave you the list today of everything in your whole life that you have to straighten out, you'd probably be very discouraged, as I would. So He only reveals things as He finds that we will respond to Him, I believe. But if you know something, straighten it out. And in the process, then, we will be a group of people that are ready to take on the challenges of showing the world who God is in the next 3 months. And those who come here, you know, I told you, students, as far as I'm concerned, I'm your cheerleader now. I'm not your teacher. You've got a different phase. You're part of what we do. Let's get it done. You need to join and begin to see God work in your life and realize that those coming up need to be led. We need to be led by the lion, not by other sheep. We need to be led by the lion. We're the sheep. And the lion makes sheep pretty bold. If you get a lion standing behind you, a lamb, it brings a whole other idea to bah. But if you don't have that lion there, all you got is a bah. If that makes sense. So let me pray. And then on your way out, grab one of these. And that will be it for our time together here. Father, again, thank You for the opportunity we had to just slow down for a moment and just see what You're doing and what You have done. And You've taken a bunch of imperfect people and you have a perfect plan. I'm convinced that there are even times where you bless some of the things we do that maybe weren't ideal, but you've seen our hearts, and the heart is what we can control. We can't control the circumstances. We can control our attitudes. I pray that as this group takes communion in various places around these woods, that your spirit will be very evident to them, that you will convict us of our sin, and that you will allow us to be in a place where we hear your voice and we can see what you would like us to do in life. We know that the things that I mentioned here are things that are mentioned in your word, and they are of your will. And so we ask you to convict us of these things. In Jesus' name.